All right, welcome back. Our fourth speaker meeting. Woo-hoo! And I am here to promote speaker CDs because that's how I stumbled across Mr. Shane here. Over the years, I've just been very blessed. People have sent me or I've received at a meeting. How I ended up with Scott was through a speaker CD, and I said, I got to find some people in Atlanta that know this guy. And I stumbled across a gentleman named Big Frank, and I've just had an infatuation with him. And I know he's a drunk like the rest of us. Mr. Marquez sent me some CDs and Mr. Shane. And I listened to them, and I absolutely loved them. It was a very soft-spoken Big Frank in certain aspects. And you can be touched. You know, God uses anything he wants to touch your spirit. And CDs are amazing because they'll, if you have the capacity to question and doubt, and then you're able to question your own experience with certain things and say, you know, maybe I should set this aside and look at it from this perspective, and then you start to have an open mind and you can really listen to the experience that people talk about and have your own, and maybe go seek somebody to share it with, you know, say, hey, let's talk about what these guys are talking about. And so I enjoyed, I don't know Mike very well yet, but Bob is a big fan of Mr. Shane and has nothing but good things to say. And I give you Mike Shane.
My name is Mike Shane. I'm an alcoholic. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you very much for asking me to come out here. I loved the talks before. Your talk, you described the dark night of the soul. And that's part of the process of the spiritual walk. Because I have to go through that every once in a while because my ego wants to start to believe that I have something to do with this. I like Carl because I was wondering if I dropped the F-bomb at a monastery. I was going to get in trouble. Carl took care of me. I've got it nailed, and I'll probably drop one before the weekend's over. And David, I love you. On the other side of, before I get into my story, I'm going to make a suggestion to you. Have an intent for this weekend. Don't come in here just, I'll get what I want. And I'll tell you what my intent is to maybe say something that one of you, maybe more, can find what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous promises me. And I'm going to tell you what that is. It promises me that the drink problem will get removed. Totally. I don't think about it. But here's the other promise that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous gives me that I live for. It promises me peace, power, happiness, and a sense of direction. And I believe I can have that no matter what's going on out here. And then that's on page 50, and then on page 52 it talks about the Mad Hatter, right? You know? Which is what I came in here as, and sometimes even go back to. My sobriety date is April Fool's Day, 1975. I had a birthday Tuesday. Turned 39 years sober. True gift. I didn't really have a whole lot to do with it. I signed up for it. This birthday has been sort of an eye-opener for me, and not because I'm emotionally attached, but my daughter called me a week before my 39th birthday, and she said my mother just drank herself to death. It's the woman I was with when I came into AA. And she left me so that she could go with another drunk because she thought I was in a program that brainwashed people. And she died in a trailer in Arkansas. She was about 85 pounds. And the story that my daughter told me was that she choked to death on oxy, and her blood alcohol count was 0.38 or something like that. And her drunk husband was passed out next to her when she died. And then what happened was, is he came out of his stupor and found her dead and couldn't deal with it, so he went to the bar and got drunk for a couple of days before he called the authorities. That's alcohol. That's alcoholism. And I think sometimes we forget that we're dealing with a life or death matter here. You know? But I hope somebody in here, you know, hear something this weekend from somebody to where you can go out and you can live your life and be happy in this skin and in this brain. See, I never could. I never could. I never was happy in my skin or in my brain. I always wanted to be somebody else, you know. I was born in a family in Madison, Wisconsin. I like to say alcohol was one of the four basic food groups. They were drinkers. They were hard drinkers. You know, a crazy weekend was just the norm. And I never really understood it. I just knew that what happened was is that my father would turn from this kind of a man, and he'd bring home his bottle every night, and he'd turn into this kind of a man, right? And he was a monster. He became a monster. And I never wanted to be like him. Never did. I was 13 years old, and I went to a junior high school dance. And I don't know what it's like today, but back then all the girls were on this side of the room and all the boys were on the other side of the room, and guys were trying to act tough and, you know, and all that. And this kid said to me, he said, "I brought a pint of my dad's whiskey with me. Let's go out back and drink it." Now, this is Madison, Wisconsin in February. Okay? It's cold. We go out back. He takes a sip. I take a sip. I give it back to him. He takes a sip. I take a sip. I give it back to him. And all of a sudden, this stuff starts to melt into me. Right? You know that feeling? You know that feeling of... everything's okay. All the fear goes away. All that loneliness, all that craziness, you know, all that thinking you don't fit just goes away. And you become anything you want to become. See, there's two sides the big book talks about to find out if you're alcoholic, and it says it real simply. It says if you suffer from the phenomena of craving, okay, do we know what the phenomenon of craving is? Heck yes, I know what the phenomenon of craving is. Every single speaker that has spoke tonight has talked about the phenomena of craving. Once I start to drink, sometimes I'll have a couple, sometimes I'll be able to pull it off, but I never know when I'm going to take off, right? I had that the first time I ever had all the booze I wanted to drink. At 13 years old, I had the phenomenon of craving. But there's another side to what the big book says is alcoholism, and that is the obsession of the mind, right? I didn't get that until I was in the military. See, let me explain that to you. When I drank, I went out to drink and get drunk. But I was able to, for a few years, I could say no. I don't want to go out and get drunk. I knew when I drank, it could get crazy, right? But it wasn't until I got into the military it became the obsession of the mind. What I mean by that is I could not think of anything else. It became the highest priority in my entire life. Somebody asked me before this meeting, we were sitting downstairs, and this lady asked me, she said, "Do you think that genetics plays a part in alcoholism?" And I said, "Yeah, it plays a part in the phenomenon of craving, but I don't think it plays a part in the obsession of the mind. The obsession of the mind is selfishness and self-centeredness if you read your big book." One of the things Frank did for me, and he was my sponsor, was he said, read the black in the book. Simple statement, man. But it's just true. So, you know, I was raising this family, and I found alcohol at 13 years old, and I was put in a boys' home by 14 years old because I was incorrigible, and I would run away with my friends, and we'd go get drunk, right? I got out of the boys' home at 17 years old. I was put back with my parents. My dad was a very abusive man. He was a very bad drunk, and when he got drunk, he hurt people. And when I was just a little kid, he'd pull me or my brother out from under our beds, because when he got that drunk, we'd hide underneath our beds. And he'd pull one of us out, and he'd sit there and bring us out and tell us we're losers and we're never going to be anything, and that kind of stuff. And he'd hit my mom. And when I got put back with them, he tried to hit my mom once. Never again. I just about killed him. And the race was on. I was pretty good in sports. My folks had moved to Columbus, Ohio. I hate Columbus, Ohio. I've got to tell you right now. That is the dingiest town I have ever lived in my life. It is always like this outside. You know, it's just all. And I made All-State in high school football, and I got a full boat football scholarship to Ohio State or a couple other schools that I could have gone to, and I went to Ohio State University, and because of Woody Hayes and because of what was going on there. And you take a kid who comes from where I come from and you put him in that scene. Well, let me tell you what I did. I drank. I didn't show up to practice. I never even made it. I made it like 4.5 months, and they kicked me out. Once you lose your scholarship, you got to pay for it, and I didn't do that. So I ran sort of hard, but what happened to me was Vietnam was going on, and my buddy, my best friend since I was that high, Jimmy Johnson. Jimmy was a Golden Gloves boxer, and actually his family used to take me in all the time. Try to protect me. They actually tried to adopt me, but back in those days, a black family could not adopt a white kid. And I loved these people. I just loved them. They treated me better than anybody had ever treated me. And so Jimmy and I joined the military and joined the Army. And we went over to Vietnam and came back a year later. And here's alcoholism. You want to know what my powerlessness over alcohol was about? I'm going to give you a good example. One of the things Frank used to do with people, and I do it today, is when I'm talking to a new drunk and they're not sure if they're alcoholic or not, I ask them about specifics. I don't want generalities, right? You're not a bad person, you know. Oh God, I go out and I fuck up so bad. You know, they're just bragging. I mean, seriously, that's what they're doing. But Frank would ask me specifics. He'd say, did you ever go out to have a good time and keep it going even though you knew you shouldn't? Well, here's what happened to me. I came back from Vietnam and they gave me a 48-hour pass. I'm at the Oakland Army Terminal. So I go into downtown San Francisco, right? And I met some wonderful people at this bar. And they were trying to persuade me to join their crew. And started drinking, and I came back like 26 days later. So here's what happened. They bus me. They take my stripes. They give me barracks probation. They put me in the barracks. And they said, don't do it again. You're out of here. You're out of the U.S. military with an honorable discharge in about 3 months. Can you just keep it together? No problem. Who said that earlier? No problem. I'm going to keep it together. Well, somebody brought some whiskey into the barracks. And I started drinking the whiskey. All of a sudden, I needed to go see my friends in San Francisco. I came back like 20-some days later. They busted me, threw me in the brig for 3 months, and let me out on general under honorable. There was five of us that had come back from Vietnam together, and we all got out about the same time, and we went running and gunning in downtown San Francisco, and we were down there in the area. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the city, but there's this area called Tenderloin District. It's inner city. I think they counted 246 hookers in a 10-block area or something. It was my kind of place, trust me. We were down there, and there was a strip club down the street on Turk Street. And it was like 10 o'clock in the morning. We're broke. We don't even have money for breakfast. And all of a sudden, this ambulance and cop cars are coming up to the strip club, and people are running out, and cops are running in. And I grabbed this guy, and I said to him, I said, "What's going on in there?" And he said, "The bartender just got shot in the head." Now, in this sick alcoholic mind, that's a created job opportunity. I walked in there, and I was asking for the job from the owner before the guy got off the floor. Not that I'm self-centered. I don't want anybody to believe that, okay? Where that's going to come in, and tonight we're here to talk about powerlessness, because we're going to you're going to hear more of Dave and I than you probably ever wanted to know. But here's the truth about it, is that we get to tell you how to recover from this disease tomorrow and Sunday, right? But this plays a very important part in my recovery, because I got in with these guys and I started running these clubs down the Tenderloin District. And here's what my life looked like. I was doing speed every day, just about. I was drinking. I was tending bar. I was partying. I was playing with loose women as often as I possibly could. And I was just a wreck. I mean, I was an absolute maniac wreck. And I was running with some biker crowds down in that part of town. And you know, it wasn't because I was a badass or anything. These were just the people that accepted you. That's all it was. These people did not care if you got really insane. And so that's what I was doing. And I was running over people. I was just running over people. But what happened was, is I met this woman. She was our head stripper in the bar that I was working at. And it sounded like a good time. And we started partying a lot. And she got pregnant. And then I got arrested. I got busted on five things all in one night. I hit a cop and just all kinds of stupid stuff. And so we decided to take off out of California and go to Denver because her folks lived there. Well, it sounded like a good idea at the time, so we came to Denver. And here's the interesting thing. Coke was not a big deal when I was doing this thing in California in the early 70s. Coke was not something that you really knew about. Crank was. Meth was big. White crosses. And then you come down 3-4 days later on Valium and Percocet and anything else you can get your hands on. But the thing was is that I used drugs in order to drink more. Okay. Now the interesting thing about my drinking story is that when I moved to Denver, I had no connections here for any of that stuff, right? And I knew the law was after me because I literally ran on these warrants. So I played it really low key and got bartending jobs in Denver. But what ended up happening to me was I gave up drugs and just started drinking, and my consumption went from basically, you know, I don't know what, but, you know, people say they drank this amount or this amount or this amount. Let me tell you, I drank it all. That's what I drank. If it was there, I drank it. And by my mid-20s, I was unemployable. I couldn't work. I'd get jobs, and they'd run out as soon as, you know, I passed out in a bar and they found me at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, and booze became a battle for me. I don't know if you can understand that, but it became a battle. It was work. The fun had gone. I got arrested in a bar fight And how they didn't find out about California, I'll never know in a million years. And I end up making amends to those, all that stuff later in my sobriety. But here's what happened is, I got out of jail. It was December 24th. It was Christmas Eve of 1974. I got arrested. It was just a bar fight, no big deal. And back in those days, they'd let you out on a PR bond the next morning. It was, you know. And I don't know, yeah, we used to call it the 13th and Champa Hilton. It was in downtown Denver. And the jailer said to all of us that were getting out that morning, he said, well, we're going to let you out at 6 so all you Alkies can get home before the bars open at 7. And I thought to myself, how dare he call me an Alkie? Right? I was drunk by 3 o'clock that afternoon. I was back in that same jail that night. See, that's what alcoholism does to people like me. You know, I am drinking to overcome a craving that I have no power over whatsoever, and I knew I was done. My biggest fear was that I wasn't going to die soon. This was going to be a long, drawn-out affair. Right? So, this woman who passed away a couple weeks ago, we were in this house, and it was a drunk's house. I drove a drunk's car. You can always tell a drunk's car, right? And you can always tell a drunk's house. I had no motorcycle. I was a biker without a motorcycle. Those things would go right away when I needed money. And I was drinking every day, and she said to me one day, she said, this was right after my daughter was born, and she said, are you going to come home tonight? And I said, yeah, I'll be home tonight. She said, I want you home for dinner. Oh, I'll be home for dinner. Well, there's a bar down on Broadway called the Blue Bonnet, and they had 3-for-1s from 4:30 to 5 o'clock only. Now, it's a real nice yuppie bar today, but back then it wasn't. And this guy said to me, he said, why don't you come on in here, I'll buy you one drink, 3-for-1, right? I came staggering in the house about 2 o'clock in the morning, and she said something to me, and I said something to her, and I couldn't tell you to this day what it was. And she, all of a sudden, I look up to my right, and I see the biggest rolling pin I have ever seen in my entire life coming straight at my head. And she hit me, and she knocked me down, and she literally beat the hell out of me. And I'm laying down there on the floor. And she called her mom, who today loves me like you can't believe. She calls me her son, her mother, who's 95 now. And I'm sorry, but she's lost 2 daughters to alcoholism, and I feel so much for her. But I'm laying on the floor, and these pictures are coming into my head, and they're like color pictures of me as a little kid just wanting to grow up to be a football player. That's all I wanted to do. Then there was this picture of me where I was. And then there was this picture of me on Skid Row, because that's where I was heading. I couldn't work, you know? And I thought, the next day I went down and I got stitched up, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and this gal named Mabel answered the phone at central office, and she said, oh honey, where are you? We'll send some guys to get you. And I said, no, you're not going to do that. I really thought, see, today AA is very cool to be in. Okay, I'm here to tell you. I know this is Fellowship of the Spirit, and this is encompassing a whole lot of people who want a spiritual answer to life, which I think is absolutely marvelous. But AA, at the time I came in, was not a cool place to be. Bob and I and others have done workshops out in Santa Barbara and Los Angeles, and they literally put it on their resumes that they're members of Alcoholics Anonymous so that they get hired. I couldn't even believe that when I came in. You didn't want anybody to know, right? And I thought these guys were going to show up in AA t-shirts, you know, and stuff like that, and try to take me away. And And I wouldn't let that happen, so I ended up going to some AA meetings, and the people were very nice. They were kind, and that I weighed 320 pounds. I had 16 stitches in my head, two black eyes, a busted nose, sweat a lot, and I walked into this meeting, and I remember it had couches, and I went and I sat down, and everybody moved away from me. And they came up and they'd say things to me like, keep coming back, and you never have to drink again. Now I'm going to tell you what I've learned since. Groups that do not have an answer are scared to death of real drunks because they have no answer for them. And this was an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting where nobody had an answer. But they'd buy me dinner, so I kept going back. And I played them. And I went back, and I'd bum $5 for cigarettes, and I'd buy booze and cigarettes for that back then. And I played these guys and I kept getting drunk until all of a sudden I went on this 3-week bender. And here's what happened to me. I went on this 3-week bender, and I put a gun in my mouth and all kinds of stupid stuff. And I was going to kill myself, and the gun didn't go off, and I threw the gun up against the wall and it went off, and I passed out, and I woke up the next morning, and I remember somebody saying, there's a place downtown called 1311 York Street, and it's for people like you. So I ended up taking my 72 Pinto down to 1311 York Street on these bald tires. And I walked into 1311, it was like 10 o'clock in the morning, nobody was there, and they got me and they sat me down at a table and got me a cup of coffee, and I'm shaking. I hadn't had a drink that morning. And I'm just starting to shake, and I didn't want to go to AA and be drunk that day for some reason. And all of a sudden, this guy comes walking in to 1311 York Street. He stood 6'8". He weighed about 380 pounds. He had a big old Pall Mall hanging out of his mouth. He had plumber butt on his pants. And he focused right in on me. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't want to talk to nobody when I'm in that shape. I want you to stay away from me, right? And he just focused right in on me. Now, I've been around AA long enough to know this. How am I doing? I'm good, aren't I? I've been around AA long enough to know that drunks love... sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous really enjoy going up and talking to a really hurting drunk. They just love to do that. It's not because they want to help the hurting drunk. It's because they want to feel better about themselves, right? And so I knew this guy's going to come up and he's going to pat me on the back. He's going to say, keep coming back, or some stupid idiotic thing like that. And he comes barreling into me. This is Big Frank. And he comes barreling into me and he sits down at the table I'm at. And he goes like this. You're fucked. He gets up and he walks into the kitchen, right? Now, if I could have gotten up from that table, I was going to take a swing at him. Here's what the man did. He comes back from the kitchen and he has this great big thing of orange juice and honey and he puts it down in front of me. And then he did something that I'll never forget. He put a straw in it and he moved it toward me. Why did he do that? Because he knew I couldn't get that orange juice and honey from that table to my mouth without spilling it. So he made it so that all I had to do is bend over and suck on it. By that one act, he showed me he knew exactly where I was. And nobody had ever known exactly where I was. I used to hear like you, you have so much potential, right? This man sat down with me, he took me home, I stayed on his couch, and he was my kind of guy. He was divorcing his wife and marrying his mistress. So I knew he was no saint. And I'm going to tell you something about people in AA. I've been around here 39 years. I've never met a saint. The people that you mentioned, Don Pritz, Gary Brown, Frank, these are all buddies of mine. Mickey, we were all in the first Big Book workshop after the 75 International Convention together. There isn't a saint among us, I got to tell you, right here, right now. But we are people who are always trying to enlarge our spiritual condition. Always. Because there's so much more here than what I came here for. I stayed on Frank's couch. I went in DTs. He got some food in me finally. He got he didn't give me any alcohol. But he would take me, a lot. Back then we used to wean people with booze a lot of the time. 1311 York always had a pint in the back to wean people off. And back then there weren't a lot of treatment centers. And one of the things that I have about treatment centers, David talked about so well, which is they want you to believe that you can get well by human aid. And in order to really and truly get well, I've got to know that I'm beyond human aid. As I have to know when I'm 5 years sober. As I have to know when I'm 20 years sober. As I have to know when I'm 39 years sober. This stuff never stops. I asked Pritz one time, I said, what do you think this sobriety thing is really and truly all about? He said, you know, Mike, I think it's just simply going from surrender to surrender. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. That and his truth without love is cruelty are the two best things Don ever said to me. You know, and he and I were good buddies. Here's what Frank did for me. Frank was the guy who I could understand because he was like me. See, I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe that there was a God. I didn't believe in getting well through a God. I didn't believe in any of that stuff. But what Frank was able to do with me was he was able to share with me that he was the same kind of drunk as I was. And here's my hook, the hook that got me into the program of AA. The idea of staying sober did not enlighten me at all. The idea of, do you have what we want? I looked around the room, not really. I thought it was a pretty stupid, boring, and glum bunch of people, quite honestly. Come to find out it's totally different if you want it to be. But what he was able to do was he was able to say that he gets to go through his life, through his ups, through his downs, through his divorce, through his this, through his kids not talking to him, through good times, through bad times, and he didn't even think about taking a drink. That's freedom. I literally was at, I was sitting at this table, I was like, I can't put time together very well in the first couple years because I was so nuts. But Frank and two other guys were sitting there. One guy was losing his lighting company. Another guy was getting divorced. Frank was doing whatever he was doing. And somebody else was doing something. And I looked at him with all sincerity and I said, doesn't that make you want a drink? I mean, I thought, when you're going through that kind of shit, you got to be able to go get a cocktail, right? And they looked at me and went, no. We don't even think about it. That's what hooked me into coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, was that I can go out and I can live a life with everything it's got to offer, right? All the ups, all the downs, all the sideways, and not even think about taking a drink. Are you kidding me? And then Frank did this. I was sitting on the front porch of York Street that same day, and I walked in and I knew deep down in my heart that I had this disease, that it was never going to get any better. That the first step tells me, folks, that I'm going to drink again. That's exactly what it tells me. There's no hope in the first step. There was a guy that recently died in Denver, and he was like 36 years old, and he drank himself to death. Like people, those of us that have been around for a long time, we've seen so many people die behind alcoholism, right? And somebody came up to me and they said, Mike, why do you think this guy died? And I just sort of looked at him. The guy says to me, well, he never must have gotten his first step. Not true. He had a great first step. He didn't have a second step. He was not willing to sign up for this deal. See, I believe in God's grace. I know that I'm here. I know that I got directed to where I belong. I was born and raised to be an AA. Now, that's not something you want to brag about. Like Dave was saying, we're all kings and queens when we come in here, right? But I was born and raised to be here in Alcoholics Anonymous, talking to a group of people who want a spiritual answer to their life on April 4th of 2014. I was born to do this. This is where it got me, right? Frank was able to, I was able to listen to him. And I was running around with all these guys that you were talking about, and we went to that 75 International Convention, and I was going through the steps with Frank at the time. And there was sort of a fight going on between the Pritz Brown camp and the Frank camp. Everybody in AA gets pissed at each other, right? I'm better than you, or you're better than me. Both groups were saying the same thing. And I knew that. Mama raised a drunk, not a dummy, okay? And I knew that. So I was going to both, and we went to the 75 International Convention. Actually, this is really funny, because there was a guy laying on the street, and I remember two of us went up to him and we grabbed him and we said, come with us, you're going to get sober. And he was just, you know, and he goes, why do I want to go with you? Well, there's free coffee and donuts. Okay, he went. And we listened to a guy by the name of Mac Cheater. Bob was, Olson was there, Brown was there, and I was there, Frank was there, Lois Wilson spoke at that convention, and Mac Cheater talked about a group called the Golden Slippers up in Canada who couldn't stay sober until they all of a sudden decided to sit down and read the book from the very first page and do what it says to do, and then they stayed sober. And they continued to do that. They continued to do that. It wasn't a one-time thing. Because Thiebaud talks about the ego rebuilding, and I guarantee you, if you're around here, the ego will rebuild. I absolutely guarantee you. It's a given. And so then all of a sudden, we started this big book workshop. And there was, I think, 14 guys who went through that workshop. And Frank was pissed off I was in that workshop, and the guys in the workshop was pissed off I was sponsored by Frank, but it's no big deal. But of the 14 people who went through that workshop, 13 of us either have died sober or still sober. So tonight I'm supposed to talk about powerlessness. I think I've conveyed to you pretty good about what my powerlessness looked like. I think you need to know what your powerlessness looks like, because you cannot catch sobriety. You have to work for sobriety. But my thing is this. It's not just about staying sober. This is not a not drinking contest. This is a getting well contest. Since I've come in, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, has not only the drink problem been removed, my entire heart's been changed. I am not the man today that walked in the doors of 1311 York Street. I'm not the man today of 10 years ago. I'm not the man today of 5 years ago. Because of those guys that went before me who had an enthusiasm about helping drunks recover. You want to know what Frank did his last week of sobriety before he passed away? If any of you have heard of him. He was in the VA hospital. He was dead broke. And he had all of us coming down there to see him, and he only wanted to see a few of us. And he was having us wheel him in a wheelchair up and down the halls. And he'd sit there with that gleam in his eye, and he would go, I wonder if there's any drunks down here. And we'd go into rooms, and he'd talk to them if they had alcoholism, because he loved helping new drunks. I was at Don's last talk the night before Don died. Don died the next day. And he gave a talk on one lung at a District 9 convention. And I walked up to Don and I said, "I love you, Don." He grabbed me. He was in a wheelchair. He grabbed me and kissed me on the forehead. He said, "I love you too." And everybody in there loved Don. These are people who did not come in here good people. But not only did they come to Alcoholics Anonymous and get the drink problem removed, but they got their heart changed. And if you're sitting there, and I don't care if you're new, I don't care if you're 5 years sober, 10 years sober, 20 years sober, 30 years sober, 40 years sober, there's hope right here that you get to live with peace, power, happiness, and a sense of direction in your life no matter what's going on out here. And then for the next day and a half, you got to listen to Dave and I tell you how to do that. Thank you.